Okay, good evening everyone. Welcome to Great Decisions, Part 14, Mechitza Mayhem, sponsored by Geico. 15 minutes can save you 15%. Now, sponsored by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib, Mechitza Mayhem tonight. So the most familiar demarcation between the Orthodox and non-Orthodox shuls today is the mechitza, which I say for the people not here, you all know, it's the separation between men and women during prayer, either through a special balcony for the women or through a partition in the main area of the davening. That's very familiar to us, but it's one of those areas of Jewish life that was passionately debated for well over a half century. Became embroiled in repeated litigation, civil litigation, now seems to be well settled, but it was not for a long time. In American Jewish life in the 20th century, it was not as accepted as it is today, and even in Orthodox Jewish life. And for good reason, at least from one perspective. It's one of those institutions in Jewish life that's known to us through the Masorah, the traditional and authorized interpretation of the Torah, and not at all through most of our customary sources. Many of you will be shocked to learn that a mechitza per se in shul is not mentioned anywhere in the Torah. It's not mentioned in the Talmud. It's not mentioned in the Gaonim. It's not mentioned in the Rishonim. You can scour the entire Shulchan Aruch, all four Chalakim, and not find a single reference to a mechitza in shul, not even in Hilchos Beis HaKnesses, where you would assume it would be delineated. So the non-Orthodox will argue that it's therefore unnecessary, and it was an innovation in Jewish life that was acceptable in the past, but is actually abhorrent today. For several decades in the mid-20th century, we'll discuss, there were many Orthodox shuls that did not have mechitzas. Some had mixed seating, others had separate seating but without a mechitza. So what happened? Because those shuls have all but disappeared. What changed? How did mechitza transition from something that was universally accepted to something that was deemed optional or preferred or repugnant or in the best of circumstances a living symbol of the Masorah, and then changed back? So that the lines today are very clear. How did shuls decide? What changed in the Jewish world? And who was responsible for the change? So this issue, of course, is much more than just one of shul architecture, but goes to the very heart of how we perceive the Kedushas Beis HaKnesses, the sanctity of the shul, and the very nature of the experience of tefillah, all of which became entangled and in many places overwhelmed by American culture, and the role of women in American society, and in fact the need to try to accommodate trends in American life to make Torah more attractive to the youth. It all starts though in the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says in Sukkah, it's the Mishnah Daf Nun Aleph Amud Aleph, the Gemara Nun Aleph Amud Beis at the bottom. Mishnah speaks of a Tikkun Gadol, a great innovation, great improvement that was made in the Beis HaMikdash at the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. And the Gemara explains that Chalaka Haisa Barishon, at first the wall separating the Ezras Nashim, the women's domain in the Beis HaMikdash from the Azara, it was smooth, the Hikifu Gezuz Torah, and then they surrounded it with the balcony, the Hiskidu Shehu Noshim Yoshros Milamala VaNoshim Milamata, and they ordained that the women should sit up top, the women and men downstairs, and then play with it for a while. So that was the final outcome. Women were in the balcony, men were on the ground. So the Gemara asks, how could they do this? Because we know everything, the Beis HaMikdash, everything had to be commanded by God. So the Gemara answers, Kra Ashkechu Udarosh. They found a pasuk and expounded it as follows. The pasuk described the basic purpose of the balcony, which was, as Rashi says, Shetzarich lahavdil anashim minashim. You have to separate between men and women. Vilasas goder b'Yisrael shelo yavoli de kilkul. And you have to make that separation a fence, So it doesn't lead to frivolity, to licentiousness. For reasons of modesty, we keep the sexes apart. And the proof text, the pasuk, is a pasuk from Zechariah, where he prophesies about the funeral of Mashiach ben Yosef, at which the Jews grieved separately. Pasuk says, "V'saftah ha'aretz, mishpachos mishpachos levad." The land mourned, families separately, mishpachas beis David levad, u'nishehen levad. The family of the house of David, the royal house, separately, and their wives separately. You see a separation already at the Yamsuf, where Miriam and the women danced alone, and Ozel Shemoshu Bnei Yisrael, they sang and danced by themselves. But the Gemara Darshan's here that if at a funeral, the funeral of Mashiach ben Yosef, as prophesied by Zechariah, if at a funeral separation is required, Umala Osed Lavo, Sha'oskin Behesped, Ve'en Yetzara Sholeipahem, involved in eulogies, in mourning, in grief, and there's no real Yetzara, no one's thinking about anything frivolous. And there, Omra Torah Anashim Levad and Anashim Levad, there the Torah emphasizes that men and women have to be separated. Now that they're engaged in the joy, Simchas Pesach Shoevo, and the Yetzara is there, Allah has kama v'kama, how much more so is the separation required? So in fact, you see there's a source for it. The Beis Hamikdash required it. The whole institution of Mechitza is based on this one teaching. Mechitza is necessary. Some form of separation is necessary. Of course, questions where you draw the line. Beis Hamikdash, shul, wedding, funeral, schools, buses, sidewalks. The question is where you draw the line. There are arguments on all sides, but our focus tonight is the shul. Since the shul is a mikdash ma'at, it's a miniature Beis Hamikdash, it stands to reason that it bears the same structure as the Beis Hamikdash. And so it did. Often we'll see remains of ancient shuls with a mechitza, either visible, or you can anticipate, or try to divine where it was. I'm a little skeptical of archaeology as a science in any event. A lot of it seems to be just interpretation and speculation, and the projection of the biases and predilections of the archaeologists. But nonetheless, it could be that some shuls had, some shuls didn't have. What seems obvious from most of the sources is that women rarely went to shul, being exempt from tefillah b'tzibur, so mechitza issue was not discussed at any length. Thus, just to take a few comments at random, the Chidah died a little over two centuries ago, in 1806. Chidah writes in the Beis Yosef, in the Birkei Yosef, his commentary on Archaim Siman Reish Pei Beis, L'chein Poshta Hora B'Gliloseinu. Therefore, the teaching went out in our exile. So Chidah was born in Israel, but he wound up, spent the end of his life in Italy, in Livorno. He says, now with the common custom, She'ein Hanashim Hochos Leveis HaKnesa Shel Noshim, Ezra's Noshim, women do not go to the women's part of the shul, Ela Ezes Kenos, V'gam Eino Bekeva. Just some old women come, and even they come irregularly. There's another mention in the Gemara, in Kiddushin Daf Pei Aleph Amud Aleph, for the separation between men and women. Rashi says the case is when people gathered for not the purposes of tefillah. Mokom kavutzas anashim v'nashim o lidrasha o lechupa. They came to learn Torah, they came to a wedding. So Gemara says that Abaye doyer golfe, Rava doyer kona. Abaye would set up earthenware jugs, kankanim shelcheres harbe. He would put jugs between the men and the women. So if either one or other tried to sneak across, then they would break a jug, and everybody would, they would know that some hanky-panky is going on. Or Rava would place reed canes, reeds, much taller than the jugs, but again, you'd have to be able to navigate through, and it would attract attention. In shul, it's important to note, we do find references that indicate that not a mechit existed, but there was a concept of the Ezra's Nashim, the women's place, usually a balcony or a side room, and it was called Ezra's Noshim, just like in the Beis Hamikdash. Every medieval shul that's extant had an Ezra's Noshim. The Altnoy Shul in Prague goes back to the 13th century. It's a separate room with windows. In Toledo, I remember seeing a shul, now it converted to a church. It's now a museum. Also, you can easily see where the mechitza was, and the sources make note of this. Even the Shulchan Aruch doesn't delineate what it is. It's referred to almost matter-of-factly. So the Elia Rabba, 17th century Prague, writes, Archaim Tofrei Shub Tes, that a man can sleep on Yom Kippur night in the Ezris Noshim. You can't sleep in shul. By the way, lesson. Note. Take note of that. You can't sleep in shul. But in the Ezris Noshim, Mishabur quotes as well, you're allowed to sleep Yom Kippur night in the Ezris Noshim. 18th century, the Prima Godim in Tofrei Shub Tes, says that women always went to hear the Megillah in the Ezris Noshim, but he questioned how they could fulfill the mitzvah there, since the acoustics were so terrible in the Ezris Noshim. Next century, early 19th century, the Shari Tshuva at the beginning of Or Chaim, Siman Nun Hei, discussed whether a man standing in the Ezris Noshim could count in the minyan. By the way, it's an issue in our shul as well. For the most part, here, I never allow a man to stand there, even if no women are there, lest the woman walk in. But it's a question. Let's say a man davens there. Is he part of the minyan? Is he not part of the minyan? It's considered a separate domain. But that was discussed again without any real definition of what an Ezris Noshim is. So these are just illustrations for the institution of mechitza, so to speak. That separation existed, was well known, and well accepted in the Jewish people, so extant that it was obvious, and its precise description was either self-evident or really not critical. All this refers to the design of the shul. In terms of the tefillah itself, you have an Tana Dvei Eliyahu in Perek Tes, which dates from the 3rd century, and it was edited to the next 5 or 6 centuries. Lo yamod odom bein hanashim v'yispalel mipnei das nashim. A man is not allowed to stand and daven in the company of other women. Proper tefillah always requires separation of the sexes. And this is the way it was historically in the Jewish world until very recent times. Now you'll think it ended with reform. The truth is it's not so. What kept this practice safe in the early years of the modern rebellion against Torah was that the Lutheran churches in Germany all had separate seating. That was the minute. They had separate seating. Men and women just didn't sit together. No mechitza, but they sat separately. If the early reform tried to replicate to the church experience, so mixed seating was considered unduly progressive, even by Christian standards. So it's not widely known. We speak of how the reform abolished the mechitza, which is true. But the early years of reform in Europe, for the most part, they did not adopt mixed seating. That came much later. It was much more common to have separate seating, but without a mechitza, like we do, for example, at weddings today or funerals. Now, that, too, is bitterly opposed by the Rabbonim, the Chassam Sofer and others, but it's not quite the same as mixed seating. The number of sources, interesting articles you could read. Jonathan Sarna wrote one in a book called The American Synagogue, edited by Jack Wertheimer. Mark Shapiro has written on this topic as well. Just to give an example, in 1845, the Reformed Temple in Berlin abolished the balcony and the mechitza, meaning for the first 50 years of its existence, it still had separate seating between men and women with a mechitza, and men and women then sat on opposite sides of the auditorium. At a much later stage, end of the 19th century, the Reformed Temple in Hamburg turned down a huge donation that was conditioned on men and women sitting together. To the Reformed rabbi of that temple, that was scandalous. So there's a difference between mechitza, between separate seating, and between mixed seating. It was the latter that we would have thought would rock the Jewish world when it was introduced. But in fact, it really didn't. And it really didn't because reform posed no threat to anybody. It was considered so far out, almost a mimicry of Christianity, that it wasn't taken seriously by anyone in the Torah world. But The Protestant churches in America did have mixed seating, and so it entered our world as well. Mixed seating in American temples was the innovation of Isaac Mayer Wise, a leading Reform rabbi of his day. In his first shul, first temple in Albany, so he introduced several changes to the liturgy. He was challenged, though, when he tried to introduce mixed seating, and it didn't work out. Eventually, he left. Well, left doesn't really describe it. He was fired for other reasons right before Rosh Hashanah in 1850. And it's a famous story. He showed up anyway Rosh Hashanah night, a shul in Albany, and he took his seat. He was physically assaulted by the shul president. A fist fight, a melee broke out. The police came, and only then did Wise take his termination seriously. He started a new temple, Congregation Anshe Emeth. All right, of course, Anshe Emeth, men of truth, in Albany in 1851. And mixed seating was introduced, according to his account, for the most prosaic reasons. They bought a church as their first building, and they simply, he writes this, they simply did not have enough funds to convert the church family pews into Jewish-style seating. So they kept it as it is, and that was it. The Torah world was very small anyway, and nobody thought much about it. Within a very short time, though, it became an ideology, wrapped at first in the mantle of women's rights. Temple Emmanuel, hard to believe, but Temple Emmanuel had separate seating also until 1854, once it was done in the northern part of New York State. Very little public reaction. And it was called, Marketing 101, family seating. Anyone against family seating was presumably against the family and against motherhood and baseball and apple pie. There was no baseball yet, but apple pie there was. So Wise was not the one to make this an ideological crusade. That would be about a decade later. David Einhorn, very fiery Reform rabbi, came to America in 1855, and he began propagating the notion that the mechitza was offensive to women, that women had equal obligations to those of men, and that putting them in what he called a cage was horrendous and unacceptable. So to Einhorn, the abandonment of mechitza was rooted in principle, the religious equality of women, and he discounted any Talmudic or traditional objection to it. In the Reform world then dominant, this notion took off, real domino effect. Within just a few decades, the temples in all the major cities had mixed seating. But again, it didn't really affect anyone else. The real conflict would begin with those shuls not identified with Reform. Now, keep in mind, in the 19th century, there was no such thing as conservative Judaism. It was Reform, and there was just everyone else. People, whether they were Shomer Shabbos or not, were considered traditional, just the way it was. The real conflict began with the shul with an interesting name, B'nai Jeshurun, still exists in Manhattan, one of the oldest, if not the oldest, Ashkenazi shul in America. It was very traditional, regular davening, mechitz and all. Its rabbi for decades, in the middle part of the 19th century, Rabbi Morris Rafel, or Rafal, came from Britain. He was apparently the highest paid preacher in the United States, not just Jewish preacher generally. He began making changes for decor and purposes. He was very traditional. Some of them resonate with us. Not selling kibbutzim. That was a real bugaboo. You know, our shul bans in the Constitution. Not allowed to do it here. Young Israel banned it also. No Young Israel shul can do that. So he stopped that. No singing during duchening others. After he died in 1868, that emboldened his successor to make even more dramatic changes, like moving the shulchan from the middle to the front. Again, it's mimicking a church. Getting rid of piyutim, which people have thought to do here, but never expressed it. In 1874, the board voted to introduce mixed pews. That unleashed a storm. 1874 now. The decision was retracted, vote on again, retracted again. The older people generally opposed it. The younger members were supportive of it. Meetings were tumultuous. And when the decision was made to abolish separate seating, one member, Israel Solomon, son of one of the founders, sued the Bnei Jeshurun in New York civil court, claiming that the change, I quote, unlawfully deprived him of seats he had purchased. Meaning he can only daven the shul where there's separate seating. He bought the seats. That's what they did in those days. You know, he can't use the seats. He was effectively robbed of a property right that he had. That was the basis of the suit. And the graven was that the shul was constitutionally required to adhere, I quote, to the rights, customs, and usages of the German and Polish Jews. You know, as if it's the same. He brought affidavits from some of the leading rabbonim in America, including Rav Avram Ash, who was the Rav of the Beis Medrash HaGadol on the Lower East Side. Congregation Bnei Jeshurun argued that it was legally entitled to make the changes. The board voted, the membership voted, especially in conforming its rituals to what was common throughout the civilized world, that is to say, mixed seating, and they brought testimony from Wise and Einhorn, their new rabbis, that mixed seating was not, I quote, antagonistic to the teachings of Holy Scripture and the Talmud. The court ruled in favor of Bnei Jeshurun, saying that Solomon's seats gave him an easement, which means a right to use, but not right of ownership. And Bnei Jeshurun had the right to change its practices, and he, the judge, could not intervene in what essentially was an ecclesiastical dispute between rabbis. Liberal Jews rejoiced over the decision. It was an American judicial imprimatur that they had done the right thing. Others were critical of Solomon, of course, that he brought, you know, family dispute to civil court. You always hear that. 30 members of Bnei Jeshurun resigned, but many, many new members joined, and the battle itself was joined. Just in a nutshell, the two sides were really fighting over principle and had no real way to communicate. One side held that Jewish values were at stake. What are those values? Women's equality, modernity, family togetherness, bringing the youth in, etc. The traditionalists held this was a violation of Jewish law and tradition, would lead to promiscuity and assimilation, and this is particularly galling, scathing to the other side, reflected an attempt to Christianize the Torah. Because Christians in America sat together, not Jews. What about the Hamonam? Well, how familiar does this sound? People wanted tradition, but they also wanted modernity. Then as now, it was not an easy formula to follow. And again, once you take the women's issues out of the mix, and after Einhorn, it didn't surface again for really 50, 60 years, the claim was, we need a way to attract the young Americanized Jews to shul. They're not going to come if they have to sit separately. Alright? On the contrary, let them, you know, socialize during davening. And of course, they wanted to do what they said was help improve the public image of Judaism in America. American Christians should not associate Judaism with, you know, the old country, Europe, and antiquated customs and rituals. They should be modern and adopt what's going on in America. By the 1890s, this was more or less a settled issue, or so it seemed. The Reformed temples had mixed seating. The Orthodox did not. There was always some ferment underneath the surface. So just as an example, in 1895, a proposal to have mixed seating at the Spanish Portuguese synagogues, the oldest shul in America, 1654, Sherif Israel, still exists as well. It was unanimously voted down by the Board of Trustees. 96 women members sent a letter to the board insisting that the mechitza be maintained. Of Orthodox synagogues then in the 1890s, only one had no mechitza. Congregation Mount Sinai of Central Harlem, which I assume no longer exists. That would change, and it would change in the early part of the 20th century. As we've discussed a few times already, when the conservative movement began, it was fairly traditional. In 19, many of the faculty were religious people. 1921, the issue of mixed seating was brought before the Rabbinical Assembly Law Committee, mainly JTS faculty, and Professor Louis Ginsberg, who had learned in Tells in Slobodka before studying at the University of Berlin, he wrote that while a balcony was unnecessary, separate seating is a well-established custom of 2,000 years, and, I quote, must not be taken lightly. Now, what was the situation at JTS for all those decades? In truth, the sources are in conflict. Some say they had a mechitza minyan, others say they didn't. I did what I thought was the right thing. I consulted the conservative rabbi just yesterday, two generation actually, so with his father, they go back to the 40s, and he said, his word, there's no mechitza minyan, never was, but there was in the old Beis Medrash a minyan with separate seating with a wall about 3 feet high separating. So that must be what was the mechitza minyan, like say where Shaul Lieberman always davened. Men, women, I don't know how many women were there to begin with during the week, but nonetheless, that's where they davened, separate. By the 70s, maybe the 80s, certainly the 80s, they had an egalitarian minyan. He didn't really know whether that Beis Medrash with the wall still exists today, whether it's used to any great extent, but obviously now the majority of their rabbinical students are females, women, so therefore the egalitarian minyan clearly trumps whatever else existed. It supplanted whatever existed before. Now, the rule of separate but equal failed here, as it did in Brown versus Kansas Board of Education, within decades. Even though he said, Hinsberg, that you can't take a mechitza lightly, within decades almost all conservative temples had mixed seating, and even Ginsburg said in 1947, it's not worth fighting over. So minority opposition in a given temple should just concede. What did they base their abandonment of mechitza? It's interesting, I could not find a responsum of the rabbinical assembly on the issue, but I did find a paper written by a female rabbi named Monique Goldberg at the Schechter Institute in Israel, published in 2004, outlining their conclusions. In brief, she said there was never separate seating, even the Beis HaMikdash, even the Ezras Nashim, despite what the Gemara says. The Tikkun Gadol of the balcony during the Simchas Beis HaShoeva was not permanent, it was just for that one event, and here she falsely cites the Rambam and the Bar Tanura and the Tiferes Yehuda, who drew no such conclusion. We can't in any event compare the Beis HaMikdash to a shul. There's no clear source in the Talmud until today, as I acknowledge. And she said there's no evidence that any shul, ancient or medieval, ever had a mechitza. And of course, she said, we are allowed to change customs when the reasons are no longer relevant, taking into account time and place and shifting values. There's one very strange conservative Jewish source that I found. It notes as follows. Restricting women to the temple gallery secured male centrality during Simchas Beis HaShoeva, a fertility celebration. I don't know where they got that from. And so protected the ecstatic worship of the ceremony from the excesses of local cults. It is unfortunate that two separate carnivals, one in the gallery and one in the main court of the Ezras Nashim, could not have been arranged. Perhaps the prospect of women dancing ecstatically in the sanctuary was regarded as too volatile given the surrounding culture's fertility rites. It's strange because nowhere do you find the Simchas Beis HaShoeva related to fertility at all. Nisuch HaMayim, Salach HaMosh Mishinai, but okay. Now she cites, and this is really a very bad habit that you find in their scholarship, she cites this 3-day Eish in Chelek Aleph Siman Ches in his Truvas from Chul Yaakov Weinberg, explaining, he was asked, how high does a mechitza have to be? And he said it's unnecessary for mechitza to be above head height, as was the custom in Hungary, and he said we can follow Moshe Feinstein's opinion that 18 tefachim is sufficient. 18 tefachim, it's almost a little over shoulder height. That even though the Hungarians say such a mechitza is too low, and it is forbidden to daven in such a shul, still, vadai shekavanasu motova. Hungarians certainly mean well, they always do. Lishmor alatsnius kafisha hoisanu gobidoris hakodim. They want to preserve the modesty that existed in past generations. Avabizmanenu nishtana hamatsav nishtano hatvaim. Now in our day, the situation has changed. Our nature has really changed as well. Vehanashim imtisha arna babayis If women would just stay home and not come to shul because the mechitza is too high for them, they'll forget the Torah completely. You can't drive them away because an excessive stringency that has no explicit source in the Shas or the Poskim. How does she derive from here that you don't need a mechitza? Because our writer picked up on one phrase that the Sri Deish wrote, Nishtana ha-matzav v'nishtana ha-tva'im, that the situation has changed. So she asserts, yeah, from in the Sri Deish's time, it changed from having mechitza above your head, like a thick wall, down, he said you could accept her Moshe, shoulder height, and now it's changed even more. And so no mechitza is required, completely twisting his words and opinions as if he would support this rejection of Torah. And she concludes, since hair is no longer considered erva, there's no reason to separate men and women during prayer. Indeed, it is offensive to the modern progressive spirit to do so. A synagogue should bring people together and not keep them apart. Now, mixed seating by the 1950s was the dividing line between the Orthodox and conservative movements, notwithstanding that by 1961 an estimated 250 Orthodox synagogues had mixed seating as well across America, including some very prominent YU people. There's one source that alleges that half of the graduates of Reeds, half of the YU Musmachim, and almost 90% of the graduates of Skokie, Hebrew Theological College, was far worse situation in the Midwest, served in pulpits without mechitzos, or so it was reported. They did not affiliate with the conservative movement, but with the Orthodox. They sometimes called themselves traditional, but many were members of the OU. Many of these shuls, almost all these shuls, were members of the OU as well. Their spiritual leaders were members of the RCA. Among the Reeds graduates, a substantial number, you're probably talking in the low hundreds, they had a clause that really was not honored to any great extent, that they could go into a non-mechitza shul for a few years, try to change it, and if they could, they had to leave, or their spich would be revoked. I don't think there's even one case that I know where spich was revoked for such a thing. It just became the way it was done. The truth is that I'm not being critical or judgmental. I'm just being factual here. Demographics were not on the side of the rabbis. There were relatively very few Orthodox shuls, and especially the decent salaries were being paid in the mixed seating synagogues. They just had more people. The shuls of mechitzos were not attracting people. So it's not as obvious as it sounds today. There are many famous rabbis, some I was surprised myself to find out, some extremely well known in the Jewish world, leaders of YU, leaders of the RCA, names that in retrospect would surprise you if I mention them, and I won't, served in shuls that had no mechitza. Some are still active in the pulpit today in shuls with mechitzos. Others had mechitzos, except, interestingly enough, on Rosh Hashanah Yom HaKippurim. On the Yom Narom, they got rid of the mechitza because they felt they'd rather bring in more Jews. And many Jews simply would not come if they were ordered to sit separately. There's an element of kiruv here, hoping that bringing them into shul under less than favorable circumstances would eventually even come to shul regularly and becoming observant, if not then their children. Rabbis would sometimes be thrown out for asking for mechitza. Other times they tried and failed and still remained the rabbi, and others just made peace with it. The real exception and the refuge for rabbis was Young Israel, because Young Israel had in its constitution, every Young Israel shul had to have a mechitza. So that became the most desirable pulpit in that sense, because you always knew there'd be a mechitza. In Chicago, for example, I only mention this because it's been written about extensively, Reb Chaim David Regensburg, Zecher Tzadok Levracha, he was the Rosh Yeshiva at Skokie, he was a long time Av Beis Din of the CRC, where Rabbi Gedalia Schwartz now serves today with distinction. Rabbi Regensburg was the Av Beis Din until 1977. He encouraged his Talmidim to accept positions in non-mechitza shuls. He was a rarity, but nonetheless, he said, Eis lasos l'Hashem. And who knows? It kept many of those shuls nominally Orthodox, their kids in yeshiva, and eventually the children wanted Orthodox shuls, kedasu kedin, so who could say? The battle heated up in the 1950s. One shul, Adaf Israel of Cincinnati, went to war over the issue. So for decades, it was Orthodox in practice, separate seating, but belonged to the United Synagogues. Again, you had this blurring of the lines for the first 50 years really, of the conservative movement. In 1896, they adopted separate but equal seating, but the membership found even that too restrictive by 1952, and they voted to have family pews. Their rabbi then was a Jew named Fishel Goldfader. It was a fascinating background. American born, 1912. He learned in Torah Vadas, so it wasn't just a Reeds issue. He went to Europe in the 1930s to learn in Mir, because he was an American. He escaped back here before the war, went to NYU, then to JTS, became the rabbi in Cincinnati, and when the young people clamored for mixed seating, he supported them. The membership voted 289 to 100 in favor. And there was another lawsuit, because the Constitution provided that the shul follow the forms and traditions of Orthodox Israelites, whoever they might be. The trial was a bit of a comedy, so just think about a non-Jewish judge listening to this. There was testimony that the shul was Orthodox. There was testimony that the shul was conservative. There was testimony that the shul was something in between. There was testimony on all sides as to what the halacha was. Orthodox rabbis like Eliezer Silva Zatzal, who was the rabbi in Cincinnati, he was opposed in his expert testimony by rabbis like Goldfader. The court ruled again, and really quite naturally, that it was not going to become embroiled in religious matters if the majority of the members and their rabbi ruled that mixed seating was permissible according to Jewish law. Whatever the rights of the Orthodox Israelites are, they would not intervene. The court would not intervene. Again, members left. That temple became a full-fledged conservative temple. Some shuls adopted the we're above it all approach. One was the Kehilat Israel of Brookline, Massachusetts, became mixed in 1925, but nonetheless wrote about itself in 1942 in their brochure, trying to recruit members. I quote, some people call us progressive Orthodox. Others call us right-wing conservative. We should like to rise above appellations and confine ourselves within no party lines, but to be humble and worthy servants of Klal Yisrael. That's an echo of what you hear today, the description of this place as conservadox, or as I like to call it, orthative. Different, you know, you find some middle ground. The Brooklyn Jewish Center fought over this issue in the 1920s and decided that the two middle aisles, like right here in front of me, would be mixed. The men would sit alone on the left side, women alone on the right side, and they considered themselves Orthodox. Yossel Rosenblatt sang at the dedication. Rabbi Dov Leventhal, the chief rabbi of Philadelphia, came to speak. All of this would set the stage for the climactic battle that would take place in Mount Clemens, Michigan, in the late 1950s. And this became one of the last battlegrounds with an unusual outcome, all extensively recorded by the main protagonist, a local businessman, Frum fellow named Baruch Litvin, Zichrono Livracha. It became a classic, his account of this case called The Sanctity of the Synagogue, published first in 1962. It's in its third edition now, it just came out last year. His granddaughter republished it with new editions. And the case marked a real turning point in the whole controversy. So the same scenario repeated itself here. His shul was Beth Tzilas Moshe, an Orthodox congregation by constitution. Membership voted in 1955 to have mixed seating. Litvin went to court right away, but he did more than that. He marshaled every possible source, contemporary and ancient, in support of his case. And he really was relentless, passionate, mishugaladavar, we would say today. But what was the environment that he was dealing with? So again, it wasn't just conservative versus Orthodox. You had the battle within the Orthodox world as well. So as we've seen, there are two approaches really in the Orthodox, two permissive approaches in the Orthodox world that can be summarized thusly. One was, what's the big deal? It's not as if mechitza is extensively discussed in rabbinic literature. So is it worth the fight if success, victory, means driving people away from Torah observance, so you'll win the shul battle, but you'll lose the war, because they'll go to the temples and be lost entirely. And indeed, by the 1950s, the non-Orthodox movements were ascendant, and this issue was considered settled. And keep in mind, the 1950s were really the heyday of the conservative movement in America. How settled was it? Consider this. Rav Moshe Feinstein's first tshuva on this issue, 1952, Or HaChaim, Simon Achelakal, Simon Mem Aleph, 41. He was asked by Rabbi Tibor Stern of Kansas City. Name ring a bell? He was a Rav in Kansas City, later became a Rav in Miami Beach. Most famous, he became the supervisor for Hebrew National for decades and acknowledged Talmud Chacham. So he raised five arguments why mechitza should not be required in the shul, why he could dispense with it. Perhaps, he said, a balcony is certainly unnecessary. But even a mechitza of 10 tefachim, which is barely noticeable, 38, 40 inches high, maybe that should suffice on the main floor. And then he argued to Rav Moshe in the Beis HaMikdash, the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, yes, there's frivolity, there's a problem of kalos rosh, of levity, improper mingling. But in a shul, during davening, a shul's inherently serious. We know all that. So why should a mechitza be mandated at all? And certainly men and women mixed in the Azara of the Beis HaMikdash other times of the year, Karm Pesach, for example. And why can't a mechitza be transparent? If you need it, make a glass so they don't feel that they're not part of the shul. Rav Moshe answered, 10 tefachim is insufficient. Mechitza has to be 18 tefachim at 65 inches high, shoulder height. And of course, during davening, it's necessary, chas v'shalom lo markein, that men and women can ever be mixed in a shul, v'shore le mare le kvod Torah Torah Ma, and God should forgive the honorable one for even suggesting otherwise. And he goes an entire discussion about the obligation of mechitza, rejecting every contention of Rav Tuvia Stern, Shmuel Tuvia Stern, and concluding that even though the makom kibbutz ledivrei harashus ve'af bechasunos, if men and women gather for optional reasons, even at weddings, misubkani emesha isazer, he said, I'm doubtful whether there's such a prohibition. Still, beveisak knesses uveshar satfilo and shul during davening, who isur bor de oraisa, a clear Torah prohibition. Vitzor shetia mechitza shel yudches tefachim beineihem, has to be a partition of at least 18 tefachim. Oshi anoshim lamala vanoshim lamata kidibei arti, or there has to be women in the balcony, men below. Litvin assembled an impressive array of statements and tshuvos from across the Torah world, across the entire spectrum, both long, impassioned essays, as well as short statements that are often published as advertisements or blurbs in the Jewish newspapers, all focused now on one basic conclusion, which really upped the ante. Quote, a synagogue which does not have a proper mechitza is not a kosher synagogue, and it is not permitted to pray there. He went to Israel. Herzog submitted a letter. The Agudas Rabbanim filed a brief from battles in the prior generation, including proclamations from all long deceased, the Chofetz Chaim, Rav Chaim Ozer, Rav Kook, Rav Meir Hildesheim Berlin, and others. He even cited an essay from Salman Schechter, of all people, which noted that a woman's place in the shul was modeled on that of the Mikdash. Rav Moshe wrote tshuvos, was active in the campaign. Rav Aaron Kuttner went through all the sources proving that we derive basic norms about shul structure and practice from the Beis HaMikdash. An example, Or HaChaim Kuf Nun Beis, Asur Listor Davar Mi Beis HaKnesses. You can't tear anything down in a shul. Elim Kein Osel Manas Livnos, unless you do it for the purpose of building. And the Mishnah Brura adds, although he makes it look like it's from the Shulchan Aruch, the heavy kenotes ever mina hechal. It's like you're chipping away a stone from the sanctuary of the Beis HaMikdash. So too, Ramah, Yehordeh, Reish, Samech, Hey, Seif, Yud, Aleph. How careful are we about separation of shul? So Ramah says, what about a bris in shul? Nikomokom, Hiozeres, Labaila. A woman cannot even enter the men's section for a bris. She helps her husband. Umeviyah hatinok ad beis hakneses. She brings the baby to the door of the shul. We do this here. V'oz lokecha ishmi meno. V'oz se sandok. Then the man takes it and then becomes a sandok. But the women, even there, the Ramah says not to come in. And of course, Rav Aaron Kotler noted the din of erva that precludes men from davening where women are improperly clad. Rav Salvechik was very deeply involved, and he wrote, I quote, "The separation of the sexes in the synagogue is a basic tenet of our faith. It dates back to the very dawn of our religious community and can never be abandoned by any legislative act on the part of a rabbinical or lay body." And a famous note reprinted now for over five decades, he said, I quote, "People should forego tefillah b'tzibur, public prayer, rather than attend services in a house of worship which has been desecrated." And he was asked, and I think, what was the Yiddish paper, the Allgemeiner? The Allgemeiner Journal. He was asked, the guy said, there's only a conservative temple in this town, it's Rosh Hashanah, so he knows he can't daven there. Can I at least go there to hear the shofar being blown? And the Rav said, absolutely not. Better not to hear the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, daven alone, than even enter that premises for religious purposes. Rav Belkin penned a beautiful essay about the role of the rabbi, and he said, why you will not sanction the abrogation of this essential and characteristic element of the synagogue. This is 1955. Who was the president of the RCA? Last week, the great Rabbi David Hollander. He wrote also a brief, and he said, to Darko Bakodesh, Mechitza is, I quote, a cardinal principle of our faith. Notice how far we've traveled already. I mean, it's not the 14th Iker of the Rambam, but nonetheless, to him was a cardinal principle of our faith. And the RCA launched a campaign to reverse the trend of mixed seating, notwithstanding that many of its members served in such shuls. Granted, many of them didn't necessarily like it. The next president, Rav Hollander's successor, Rabbi Sharfman, Salma Sharfman, filed the RCA statement with the court after the Rav sent a message to RCA convention saying basically, don't wimp out. The RCA, I quote, stands now at the crossroads to fight for an undiluted halacha which is not often in the vogue, or to deteriorate into a so-called modern rabbinic group of undefined quality and of a confused ideology, vague in its attitude and undecided as to its policies. I should write that down and use it today. He charged the rabbis, quote, with displaying indecisiveness and even cowardice in this matter, laxity and indifference, and choosing the derech sara v'aruka, the easy way, which leads to doom and disaster. And he said, no rabbi, however great in scholarship and moral integrity, has the authority to endorse, legalize, or even apologetically explain this basic deviation. No pretext, excuse, missionary complex, meaning kirov, or unfounded fear of losing our foothold in the Jewish community can justify the acceptance of the Christianized synagogue as a bona fide Jewish religious institution. That being said, it should be noted that while Rav Moshe held that a mechitza was a Torah requirement, the Rav held that mixed seating was the issa d'oraisa, while separate seating without a mechitza was an issa d'rabbanan. And for the Rav, the main issue was mingling, not seeing, as Rav Moshe had it, or conversing. So he generally permitted mechitzas that were only 10 tochim high. And he said he was familiar with shuls in Europe that had a mechitza that was deemed insufficient by some of the frum, like one large shul in Vilna that had a balcony that made a mechitza, and the Haredi world refused to daven there. Even more, Rav Shechter tells a story, it's written in Beis Yitzchak, a young student asked the Rav for his help in getting a Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur position in a shul, and when told it was without a mechitza, the Rav said that in his opinion, you know, such a place is like a church. But there are many such places in America that have Talmidei Chacham from Europe who retain these positions. So again, Kedarka Bakodesh, if you want to rely on those Mekilim, then he said, I help you get the position, but I would prefer to help you get a position in a fully Orthodox shul. And yet, elsewhere, the Rav wrote, quote, a very strong statement, it's completely irrelevant to our problem whether 50 or 5% of the membership of the RCA occupy pulpits and synagogues with improper seating arrangements. The violation of a religious or ethical principle does not affect its validity or cogency, even though a large segment of the community is engaged in doing so. A transcendental tenet is binding, regardless of its unpopularity with the multitudes. And now he said, was the commandment against murder declared null and void while the Nazi hordes were practicing genocide? All right, so today the Rav would be accused of exploiting the Holocaust, and whatever he said would be lost. Generally, the Rav rooted his objections as follows. Mixed eating is forbidden, Gwent Halacha. It's a defining characteristic of Jewish houses of worship since the Beis HaMikdash. And again, Kedarka Bakodesh, he philosophized in such a way that really resonates today. He said, I quote, family pews contradict the entire spirit of tefillah, which is communion with the Ribono Shel Olam and withdrawal from everything else. During prayer, man must feel alone, removed, isolated. He must then regard the Creator as an only friend from whom alone he can hope for support and consolation. Mixing men and women contributes little to the sanctification of the place or the deepening of religious feeling. And he said, as prophetic, we have to go to battle, and I do not believe this battle to be a lost one. The Sanctity of the Synagogue, now in its third reprint, extensively details all the arguments in the court case in Michigan. Now you'll wonder, what's the Shiloh really? Every other court that came across this case said it's a religious decision. First Amendment, they're not going to intrude on the rights of rabbis. Litvin adduced voluminous testimony that a mechitza was required in Orthodox practice, and interestingly, lawyers, the defense decided not to cross-examine any of the witnesses or introduce any evidence on its own. They just sat mute, relying on the prior cases that upheld the congregational choice and maintaining it was a purely religious matter in which the court should not intervene. And indeed, the trial court in Mount Clemens ruled for the defendant, the shul. Litvin was persistent. He appealed to the Michigan Supreme Court, and the Michigan Supreme Court reversed, holding that since the only evidence adduced was that mixed seating was a violation of Orthodox law and therefore a breach of the shul's constitution, well then it can't remain like that. But terrible lawyering on the part of the shul. Had they responded, the court likely would have punted. Litvin won. The mechitza was maintained. He became a pariah in his own town. Nobody talked to him. By 1969, a dying shul, Beth Tilas Moses in Mount Clemens, Michigan, was sold, had to be sold to a church, and it closed. But there are other cases, almost all defeats for mechitza. The Mount Clemens case was the only victory, but what a revolution it wrought. The very fact that there was litigation, public, obvious, blatant, was a clarion call to the Jewish world that there was such a concept as mechitza, and it could not be waived. What was Litvin's major and enduring triumph? He made mechitza part of the Orthodox brand. Thenceforth, mechitza was identified with Orthodoxy. Non-mechitza, whatever the shul maintained, non-mechitza was identified with something that was not Orthodox. And that was extremely important because it gave clarity, which is self-critical, but also gave strength and muscle to rabbis who wanted to make the change. Meaning, until this point, people in these shuls could argue, well, we want to be Orthodox. Evidently, part of Orthodoxy sustains the notion that you don't really need a mechitza. That's the part of Orthodoxy I want to join. I want to support the progressive Orthodox. Some shuls without mechitzas eventually left the Orthodox fold. Some closed up because they were in these godforsaken places anyway. But within a decade, it became extremely rare for any mechitza shul to go the other way, and the tide had turned. And thenceforth, almost every case we have, certainly by the 70s, is of a non-mechitza shul putting in a mechitza and becoming Orthodox. Thus, you have one famous case, young New Jersey Hebrew school teacher sent by YU to officiate for the Yom Narayim, 1963, to the West Side, to what was then called the Lincoln Square Conservative Synagogue. His name was Rabbi Stephen Riskin. He told them, this he writes in his new book, he told them, by the way, he appended this also to the third edition of the Sanctity of the Synagogue, he told them he would officiate, but he would daven privately. He would not daven there as long as there was mixed seating. He would not daven there until they agreed to drop conservative from the title. They became Lincoln Square Synagogue. Nor would he take a salary from them as long as there was mixed seating. He, of course, was extremely charismatic and talented. By the spring of 1964, they were sitting men and women separately. For the most part, there were holdouts. He told them then, as on Purim time, they just had a child, as young as his oldest daughter, that they had to vote on him remaining the rabbi, the condition being, if they vote for him, they're voting for permanent separation of men and women in tefillah. He didn't say mechitza, by the way. Permanent separation. They didn't have to vote on mechitza. Vote on him as a human being. They voted for him, and that Shabbos, he put a mechitza in the apartment in which they davened. Some people felt duped, because he mentioned nothing about mechitza, but he said, you voted for me as rabbi, I'm now the Mar D'Asra, these are the stands that I set, if you want, you could vote again. Based on what I've done, they in fact did vote again, he won again, only one member resigned. Baruch Lipton had been a primary supporter of Rabbi Riskin in this endeavor, and a major influence. They had a mixed minion still, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur at the Esplanade on West End Avenue, where I lived for 2 years. That was his final year, 1964, and that was it. And many other such stories across the country. How important was the brand? I'll tell you something. One of the defining elements of the movement today called Open Orthodoxy, which is really neoconservatism, is the embrace of feminism. So trying every which way to incorporate women in the davening and leadership and rabbinical roles, etc., except for one area which remains untouched and off limits, and which obviously must stick in the craw of many feminists, and that's the mechitza. Why don't they just give that up? Because the Orthodox brand demands it. Everyone knows, even if they don't like it, you cannot define yourself as Orthodox and not have a mechitza. It's as simple as that. And that is all a result of what Baruch Lipton accomplished. In a half century, everything was changed. Even today, the RCA will no longer automatically accept and will usually reject rabbis serving in non-mechitza shuls. It's on the application itself. Nor will the OU. OU now has just one mixed shul, one shul with mixed seating in Denver. Still a member of the OU, grandfathered in from the old days. I guess I have great-grandfathered in from the old days. All the others have converted back, built mechitzos, and of course others joined the United Synagogue in the 1960s. Today everyone knows that a shul needs a mechitza. We deal with ancillary issues regarding non-Orthodox temples. What do you do if someone makes a wedding? Can you make a wedding there? What do you do if someone makes a simcha there? Can you enter? If we're there, do we daven in the hallway, daven in the sanctuary? The battles are far different. Owing in part to the effective merger between the Reform and Conservative movements today, which in essence are ideologically identical, and because we've been able to define Orthodoxy as a result of those great battles in the 1950s. And one other point, the Torah world was emboldened by this struggle in all parts, especially YU, which became much more cohesive after this. And this issue, Mechitza, unified all parts of the Torah world, even as other issues, studying college, Israel, divided. And there's very interesting backlash as well. Rabbi Hollander, Zichron Levracha, wrote in 1955, trying to persuade the members in Mount Clemens to keep the Mechitza, he said, it's only fair. Orthodox Jews cannot daven in good conscience in a Reform conservative temple without a mechitza, but there's nothing prohibiting Reform and conservative Jews from davening in a shul with a mechitza, similar to the argument we use with kashrus, right? Everybody can eat kosher food, some people cannot eat non-kosher food, so serve kosher. It's no longer true. That's again how sharp the division is these days. By the late 1990s, and especially with the rise of a disproportionate number of female non-Orthodox rabbis, it was considered revolting and loathsome to pray with separate seating. It's not a b'di'evet. To them, it's a lechatchila. It's a gross violation of conscience. And I have seen it myself. I've experienced it myself. They will refuse in principle to attend any shul or participate in any minyan that has a mechitza. And I've seen this on a number of trips I've taken with non-Orthodox rabbis. They will insist on praying alone, all right, in a mixed group, because they will not enter, certainly not the women, but even the men, some men will not enter a place where there is a mechitza. Our shul started B'nai Yeshurun, 1958, Constitution, Article 2, Section 1B1, at no time shall worship services take place in the synagogue without men and women being separated, whether by balcony or by mechitza. But at least there was clarity, and it was the tireless work of Baruch Litvin, Zichrono Livracha, that in a real sense turned the tide and contributed to the salvation of the Orthodox shul and community in the United States. Shuls were saved for Torah because of the struggle. So were souls, generations, and the Torah itself. So much so that in the last 30 years, the mayhem, the mechitza mayhem, has been in the opposite direction. The litigation is completely reversed. Remember this in Kew Gardens Hills, the Jewish Center, Utopia Jewish Center, the Jewish Center in Teaneck. Temples whose constitutions required mixed seating, trying to accommodate, sometimes even sell their buildings to Orthodox Jews and have minyan of mechitzos. Members went to court. Members, I remember even here it happened in Teaneck, they flew in from Florida. Jewish Center, Kew Gardens, the same thing. People never came Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. They flew from Florida to vote against having any minyan with mechitza on principle. Even went to court to stop it. Exactly opposite of what took place in the 40s and the 50s. Complete reversal of fortune, of attitude, of hashkafa that could not have been anticipated even 50 years ago. Certainly not 60 years ago. In that, Baruch Litvin played a disproportionately large role. Yehi Zichro Baruch. Next week is Veterans Day, so we're off. 2 weeks we again cross the oceans and take up the Hahamtana. But it is, give me 1 second. The waiting period before the Six-Day War. Why did they wait so long to attack? What were the considerations? What was the danger involved? How did the Israelis perceive it then? That great decision of the spring, May, June 1967. We'll look at that 2 weeks from tonight. Yes?
This is brought up on Matheson. This is a case that here.
Yes. So first of all, it's a balcony. So balcony is a different rule.
In the
measure, it's also raised. It's raised about 2 or 3 inches. But if you notice, there's no part of the main shul or here that would necessitate men to see the women. It's only if they turn around and look, all right? Only one person who can see the women from his seat, and that's me, okay? I can't always be trusted, but I don't see that far anyway. It's also, the glass is also tinted, by the way. So you never get a clear view, and all this was discussed when it was put in. But because it's raised, it's a din of a balcony. Mechitza is really something down the middle. It's a din of a balcony. So tell your machatenis that she can come back, unless you don't want her to come back, then tell your right. Stay away. Thank you all very much.